Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. Geologist and former Apollo 17 astronaut Harrison Schmitt headlines episode 34. Later, we zero in on an issue that Schmitt raises, that of volcanism on the Moon. Before we dive in, a few terms. Regolith is the pulverized layer of rock resulting from millions of years of bombardment by meteorites and the heating and cooling cycles of the Sun fragmenting rocks. N15 is an isotope of nitrogen. A common nitrogen is composed of 7 protons and 7 neutrons, and so is called N14. N15 has, like all isotopes of nitrogen, 7 protons, but has 8 neutrons. Finding N15 can tell you a lot about a rock's history. A GA is a giga year, that is, a billion years. In August of 2021, Schmitt was introduced by Lisa Scott Carmel.
So our keynote speaker today, it is my great honor to introduce, is a retired NASA astronaut and former U.S. Senator. He was also part of the Apollo 17 crew. He is a geologist and the only professional scientist to have walked on the Moon. Welcome, Dr. Harrison Schmitt. It is an absolute honor to have you with us today.
Well, it's my honor to be with you. It really is, and I appreciate the invitation very, very much. And what I'll try to do today is to very quickly summarize what I think are some of the major highlights of the new science from Apollo, the legacy of Apollo. And in fact, in the back of your mind, you might be thinking that a great deal of the insights that have led to this came from the very first mission. Apollo 11 sample collection, Neil Armstrong's observations, led us to many of these insights that have been developed over the remainder of the missions and through 50 years of analytical research in synthesis that is ongoing. It's really quite remarkable how this continues to be, as I think Clive Neal and others have said, the gift that keeps on giving. Let's look at the Moon first. It was certainly the object of our affections for Apollo. The origin of the Moon, there were many options early on when we started. We really have constrained those, I think, to two options. There's, of course, the giant impact hypothesis, which is the favorite of the most in the lunar community. And my own preference, though, is for a cold to hot accretion in the Earth's feeding zone. We can maybe talk about that a little bit later. The internal structure of the Moon has not only come from the information gathered by Apollo, but also subsequent missions, and particularly GRAIL. We can't forget that. The crust, 30 to 60 kilometer thickness crust now, that probably started out as more uniform, but has, because of the extremely large basins that have formed, South Pole Aiken and Procolarum in particular, it has been modified significantly. The upper mantle, probably about 500 kilometers down. The samples, we finally are identifying, I think, a few samples that have come from the lower part of the upper mantle. And the seismic evidence, of course, from Apollo and subsequent analysis has been important in that. The lower mantle below that, about 800 kilometers below the upper mantle, is apparently primordial. The volatile samples from the ash, the orange and black pyroclastic ash from Shorty Crater, are beginning, and other information is beginning to, I think, indicate that the lower mantle was never molten and does preserve some of the primordial information about the origin of the moon. And of course, there's a core around 350 kilometers in radius. There's been seismic, dynamic, paleomagnetic signatures, a number of independent indications of a core about that size, and one which for a period of time produced a dynamo and a global magnetic field. Also, there has been a great deal of speculation over the decades about overturn of the upper mantle. I think it probably did not happen generally, but there's good evidence, I believe, now from Apollo 17 that the upper mantle did in fact overturn and brought samples of the upper mantle near enough to the surface that large impact events like Imbrium could sample them and spread them to where we could find them, for example, in the Taurus Littoral Valley. The regolith has occupied a great deal of my attention recently. We have numerous samples, particularly a very broad collection from Taurus Littoral. And that regolith is providing us with a detailed history of the near side lunar surface from about 3.83 GA. It also provides a library of the sun, particularly the deep drill core. And if I was going to recommend something for the future, let's get a far more deep drill cores on the moon than we have to date. It is indeed, as Shoemaker told us decades and decades ago, it will be the library of the sun. And I think we're finally learning how to translate that library. The resources for living in space certainly are included in that regolith, basically everything we need in order to be self-sufficient, ultimately self-sufficient on the moon. And then, as you know, one of my favorite topics is helium-3 fusion energy for Earth, clean energy here on Earth for the future. Now, as I mentioned, we are looking at the regolith and particularly the deep drill core from Apollo 17 as a record of the history of the sun. And a couple items that have come out of that is that the nitrogen-15-14 ratio increased by a factor of about 2 after 4.2 GA. We're still trying to define that more precisely, but there's no question that ratio was very different before there was a dynamo magnetic field, and very different than we see today. In fact, the Del-15 nitrogen changed from less than minus 200 per mil to today about minus 107 per mil. Really quite impressive difference, and probably represents an increase in N15 production in the sun's main sequence. And also from that drill core at Apollo 17, we've been able to define that there was an increase in the energy of the solar wind by a little over a factor of 2, probably about 550 million years ago. We'll mention that again here in a moment. And of course, one of the main scientific reasons and justifications for trying to understand the moon is to better understand the Earth, and particularly the early history of the Earth, which has been largely obscured to us due to the very dynamic processes that take place here at home. The magma ocean concept that came out of the Apollo 11 samples indicated fractional crystallization of a global magma ocean, probably on all the terrestrial planets initially. And I think we can look to the potential origin of the continents as a result of the differentiation of extremely large masses of impact, water-rich melt that occurred because of large impacts such as Procolarum and South Pole Lake and here on Earth, probably much more numerous, of course, on the Earth than on the Moon. As some of you are aware, I've looked in the past at the alteration of the impact debris of the Earth in a water-rich environment, its alteration to synthetic cement clay, to give templates for the organization and chemical modification of organic molecules. And there is some support for this hypothesis in what we have learned about the clay, the types of clay that are on Mars. And it may be that this 550 million year old increase in the energy of the solar wind is responsible for the Cambrian explosion here on Earth, where the diversity of and quantity of life in the oceans exploded.
It looks like we have a question here in the chat. What is the evidence that the pyroclastic samples are volcanic in nature and not of other origin, including plasma electron events?
I think the primary evidence is the drive tube core that we took at Apollo 17 site at Shorty Crater. It gave us almost 70 centimeters worth of layers that exposure ages, the GCR exposure ages tell us that those eruptions occurred over a period of maybe as much as 200 million years. And that it also included pyroclastic gases, including water and other components that have isotopic signatures that appear to be primordial. I remember Jerry Wasserberg saying to me that he just didn't understand the lead data that comes from those samples. I think the best way to understand it is that it's coming from the upper part of the lower mantle where we have essentially primordial materials preserved. There's also, of course, evidence for other pyroclastic eruptions at Apollo 17 and also at Apollo 16, these very low titanium ash materials that have been found at both sites indicate that there was another type of pyroclastic eruption. We have not really been able to study those anything like we have studied the pyroclastic ash from Shorty Crater. But nevertheless, the evidence is very strong that we also had very low titanium ashes erupted, probably in the same general time frame as the orange glasses, but ashes. But again, it's difficult to study just individual particles when you don't have that in situ kind of geological information, field geological information that we were able to collect at Shorty Crater.
Great. And it looks like we have a couple of questions related to your moon creation theory. And everyone is asking if you could elaborate on that.
Well, I just find and always have, frankly, the giant impact hypothesis increasingly complex to explain what I think we know geologically about the moon. What we know, I think, points to a relatively cool accretion up to maybe a radius of about 1,200 kilometers. And then because of the conversion of kinetic energy to heat, the origin of a magma ocean during accretion by that process. And for the case of the moon, that represented another 550 kilometers with the differentiation of that magma ocean, I think very well documented now. It has to do with a gut feeling that we can explain what we know much more simply by a cold then hot accretion than we can through these very complicated computer models that support the giant impact hypothesis. They're really magnificent models, but I find it that they sort of violate the rule that what is the simplest answer is usually the right answer.
Absolutely.
And again, the isotopic evidence is that the moon accreted one way or the other, accreted in the Earth's feeding zone around the infant sun. And that also, I think, is a very important fact that we've really had to work hard to find any differences between the isotopic composition of the moon and the Earth. And that in some sense does support something like a giant impact hypothesis, but it also just says accretion took place in about the same part of the solar system.
The 12th man to walk on the moon is now back working as a geologist after a stint as a United States senator. Before the Apollo lunar missions, a great scientific debate raged about whether the moon had a volcanic past or, indeed, a present-day volcanism. In November 2021, Catherine Elder of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory put the case for recent volcanism at a feature called INA, I-N-A.
So INA is one of about 70 irregular Mare patches that have been discovered on the moon. Irregular Mare patches are some sort of volcanic landform, and that's about where the consensus about them ends. Crater size frequency distribution, optical maturity, and steep slopes all suggest that irregular Mare patches are very young, with crater counting suggesting that they may be less than 100 million years old. However, this cannot be explained by existing thermal evolution models. For example, Zeith et al. 2009 showed that partially molten layer could be maintained in the lunar mantle until about 2 billion years ago. And at the time, the youngest volcanism that had been suggested on the moon was about 1.2 gigayears. And so they argued that with the addition of heat from the PKT, which their model did not include, and considering the uncertainty on the crater count ages, they argued that a partially molten layer 2 billion years ago was roughly consistent with the observed lunar volcanism. However, partially molten mantle only until 2 billion years ago could not explain volcanism as recently as the past 100 million years. So one of the formation hypotheses about the irregular Mare patches is that they are highly vesicular magmatic foam. And Wilson and Head and a number of papers by Chow et al. Have suggested that the material properties of this magmatic foam might be such that they affect crater size and thus inferred ages. And so these authors have argued that the irregular Mare patches are actually comparable in age to the surrounding Mare volcanism. However, with this highly vesicular magmatic foam, you would expect that to affect the morphology of the craters that are observed on the surfaces. And a recent paper by Basilevsky and Michael showed that the morphology of craters inside INA are similar to those on the slopes outside of INA. And they argued that the crater morphology was inconsistent with an ancient formation of the irregular Mare patches. So there are significant questions remaining both about the age of INA and also about its formation hypotheses. So we suggest two main science goals. First, is INA an example of endogenic geologic activity on the moon within the last 100 million years? And what are the eruption dynamics or compositions that led to the unique morphology of INA? These goals would be responsive to the decadal survey question about the workings of the solar system, and also the more specific decadal survey question about the distribution and timescales of volcanism on the inner planets, as long as you assume the moon is a planet. These goals are also responsive to a number of the goals in the scientific context for the exploration of the moon report. So to achieve these science goals, we suggest five science objectives, including determine the age of INA, determine whether the properties of INA's smooth mounds are similar to lava flows covered with regoliths seen at Apollo landing sites, pyroclastic material, or magmatic foam, determine INA's composition and whether it is distinct from known Mare deposits, determine whether the material at INA's smooth mounds is crystalline or amorphous, and determine the water composition and content of the smooth and uneven terrains of the irregular Mare patches. And so to address these science objectives, we would need to land on INA. The largest smooth mound is probably the easiest place to land and would be suitable for these objectives. There are a lot of great science objectives that you could address at INA. To me, the most important question is it really recent volcanism? And as far as I know, the best way to conclusively resolve that debate is to do in-situ geochronology or sample return. Though I will note that the uncertainty on these measurements could be quite high because the disagreement over Ina's age spans two orders of magnitude. So if we could conclusively show that it was anything under 1 billion years old, that would be a huge result. To address the science objectives we've outlined, you would also need a camera, a multispectral microimager, and a point spectrometer. I consider mobility enhancing, but it depends on your science objectives. And then a heat flow probe would also be enhancing. Additional instruments to really nail down the composition would help as well. And ground penetrating radar could help distinguish between the different formation hypotheses of Ina, since the different formation hypotheses would lead to different subsurface structures in the smooth mounds. And that's actually all I had.
James Head is now at Rhode Island's Brown University. During the Apollo missions, he was a geologist advising the astronauts. In March of 2022, he was asked whether there are any pyroclastic craters on the moon.
Yes, yeah, it's a very good question. And we do, in fact, see a lot of differences in the abundance of floor fractured craters on the moon. They're very common. Well, you know, there are a lot of them on the moon, as you know. But we don't see very many. We see only one example potentially on Mercury, for example. We may be better able to see these with the BepiColombo data coming in the near future, but I suspect that there aren't as many. On Mercury, that's one thing. On the surface of Venus, we don't see very many at all. Most of the craters are pristine impact craters. There are only about 1,000 impact craters, so you know it appears that they form after the volcanism, so that may be one reason we don't see many floor fractured craters. And then, of course, on Mars, we should see them, but there are only a few, and they're not quite the same as the ones on the moon. So I think it has to do with differences in the characteristics of the crust, and also, you know, when the magma is coming up, of course, when does it stall and create a sill, if you will, as you know, and maybe those depths are different. If they're deeper on you know, Mars, for example, then in fact, you wouldn't see the floor fractured craters. So keep going with that research and asking that question, because it's really critical to think much more about this, because the floor fractured craters, as you know, are a clue to a lot of things about the planetary history. And if you can establish that signal, it would be really, really critical. So good luck, and please keep me posted on your work.
Volcanic glasses were found by the Apollo 15 crew. Would these be subject to space weathering?
Well, the volcanic glasses, mostly if they sit literally on the surface, they will be subject to space weathering. But the kinds of things that Dave Scott discovered, like, for example, on Apollo 15, they were in aggregated clods, sort of like, so they were all together. So they actually were not welded together. They were just poorly cemented together, and they've been protected from space weathering because they were at depth. A little crater that Dave discovered actually excavated these from depth, so they hadn't been exposed to space weathering very long. So however, looking at those fresh, they're 3 billion years old, but fresh materials, we were able to discover, the scientists were able to discover surface correlated gases, volatiles. And so one of the things that we've been working on, Professor Saul and others have been working on, is what is the distribution of volatiles from the outside to the inside, using much more modern techniques than were available at the beginning of the Apollo program. So it's a really critical thing. And we try to look at those that haven't been altered by space weathering. I mean, I think the space weathering, one thing is that it can add materials that make it look like more water exists. So we try to compare those that probably were exposed to space weathering to those that weren't, to try to sort out, is water being added by the space weathering process?
And so the question of volcanism on the moon is not fully settled.